From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel, the Iron Maiden Brown.
They call me Ben. We are joined with our returning super producer, Paul Deccant. And most importantly, you are here. You are you. That makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. By the self-described moniker, one of our co-hosts just added, you may sense a bit of foreshadowing in today's episode. Today's episode is a little dark, but let's get into it with an anecdote.
I get adequate food and adequate clothing and medical care when I require it.
Voice you just heard was Admiral Jeremiah Denton of the United States Navy. On July 18, 1965, his U.S. Navy jet was shot down while leading an air attack over North Vietnam. He was captured, and he remained in the country as a prisoner of war until 1973. It's quite a long time. Now, during that first full year that he was a prisoner of war, he was interviewed for this propaganda piece, essentially, from the North Vietnamese. He was filmed being interviewed by a member of the Japanese press. And during this interview, he states several things that you heard. He's getting adequate food and clothing and medical care, and also that he supports the United States government and all of its actions. And that's probably not something that his captors wanted him to say if it truly was a propaganda piece, which it appears to be. But here's the thing. What you can't see because you're not watching the film is that he is blinking all the while that he's talking. And what he is spelling out is actually Morse code. And he's spelling out the word torture. And we actually have a quick clip here of what that would sound like.
And this stuck out to the analyst on Uncle Sam's side because they knew that Denton did not have some sort of medical condition that would cause him to blink erratically.
Absolutely. And when the U.S. Naval Intelligence got a hold of this, this was the first time they had had any kind of communication from one of these prison camps that was existing in North Vietnam that actually stated in any way that they were being tortured, that the American POWs were being tortured.
And he's doing this repeatedly in different interviews, or is this all in one sit-down?
This is one sit-down, but okay. He is just continually spelling the word torture.
On a loop. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And these propaganda videos were relatively common in this age from different governments, where you would have someone say, yes, we are being treated well, we are being taken care of, when multiple outside sources suspected that this was not the case. Today's episode is diving into dark and grisly territory, and we would like all of you, friends, neighbors, conspiracy realists, and skeptics alike, to know up front that this show is going to contain graphic descriptions of horrific physical and mental abuse. You see, today we are exploring the past, the present, and the future of torture. Given the ubiquitous nature of torture throughout human history, even before recorded human history, because we were as a species torturing each other before we were writing things down, we won't be delving into too many specific cases, but we will inevitably run into several strange examples of this practice. So here are the facts. First things first, what's the operative definition of torture?
Yeah, torture is the deliberate infliction of physical and or, I mean, I guess it could be one of the other psychological pain with the purpose of obtaining information or extorting a confession from the victim and thus enabling a conviction. It can also be the penalty itself. And I get that that's like a good cut and dry definition of it. Don't some people torture just for the sheer thrill of doing it with no end game in mind?
Well, a lot of this comes from the UN outlining exactly what torture is in 1984, I believe.
Right, right. The acronym UNCAT, which might be the only funny thing about this episode, which we will dive into. And that's a great point because this sounds on the surface like a pretty solid definition, but of course not everyone agrees with it because there is torture simply for sadistic purposes, typically not from a state level actor. It would be someone who wants to torture someone and maybe they're doing it while employed by the state, but they're getting their own dark giggles in the process.
And then what about the difference between state-sponsored torture and enhanced interrogation?
Right, right. Is this a brand name difference? Is there is it a matter of degree or are they fundamentally different things? Experts like G.R. Scott, who in the late 19th century wrote a book about torture, says that it's devilishly easy to make a definition of torture that's either too narrow, only a specific kind of thing can be considered torture, or it's too wide in scope. You know, like I was tortured because I had to listen to someone tell me yet again the plot of Looper. That's not quite torture. I mean, maybe it is if they just do it forever for a year. But for today's purposes, we're going to go with the definition that Noel just mentioned earlier. The systematic use of torture in criminal procedures or criminal proceedings dates back to some of our earliest civilizations, and it's creepy when you think about it. Scenes depicting torture can be found on different monuments, right?
Oh, yeah. In everywhere in these ancient areas, from Mesopotamia, Egypt, all over.
Yeah, and the first records of a legal application of torture to prove something, to prove guilt or innocence, were found in the Sumerian Code of Ur-Nammu. It's around the 21st century BCE, and then the Babylonian Code of Hammurabi in the 18th century BCE again. Mm-hmm. And the procedure described the divine judgment of the water ordeal, which is what it's torture. And as this practice became increasingly codified, because it was already common, right, in different raiding parties from tribes and so on, as it became part of the rule of law, the administration of torture took different directions depending on the civilization. So ancient Greeks and Romans used it for interrogation. And this is really interesting because this is something that haunts us, I would argue, in the current age. Until the 2nd century AD, torture was only supposed to be used on slaves, with some notable exceptions. In fact, a slave's testimony in any sort of legal proceeding was only admissible if they had been tortured first.
That's insane.
What? Yeah, that's the assumption is that you couldn't trust slaves to reveal the truth of their own accord.
That is messed up on so many levels.
It is, because can you imagine being a slave and saying, yes, I know, I saw, you know, Sabat or whatever take the water jug. And I'm like, look, we believe you, but I am going to have to break like one of your hands.
Well, and then are you sure you saw him take it? Mm-hmm. Are you sure and continue breaking until the person says no?
Well, and I'm sure we're going to get into this later, but it's like now we know that torture typically renders accounts unreliable, right? Oh. Because you're going to say whatever it takes to make them stop.
Oh, we're going to get into that on exactly how reliable or not torture techniques are.
Yeah.
Yeah. This idea, though, this fundamental assumption about the efficacy of torture is like a concept that haunts humanity like a ghost.
Yep.
And it the consequences of this philosophy remain with us today and have been here for millennia. In some areas of the world, acts of torture were grouped into different categories. You would have something like first, second, or third degree, and they were rated in terms of pain. And unlike the modern way that degrees are interpreted in the legal system of the U.S. today, like first degree murder is worse than second degree murder.
Yeah, it's just right? Flip that.
Just flip it. So first degree torture in this kind of system would be something that causes pain but does not permanently mutilate the body, such as whipping or the many variations thereof, or just, you know, beating the ever-loving snot out of someone. One variation of whipping would be something called bastinado or falica. It's foot whipping. So it sounds silly at first when you're thinking, oh, you're just slapping someone's feet. No, their feet were ripped to shreds and they needed these to walk. So that's the first degree.
And the second degree ups the ante quite a bit, I would say. And this is where you'll find things like vices or racks, things that either crush or, you know, like stretch to the point of not killing, but pretty much mutilating someone. These are like screw presses, where your thumbs would be crushed or toes or really any, you know, knees, feet, teeth, any kind of way, basically. That's where you get to second degree, where you're not going to look and function the same after you've been tortured.
And you may well die, but they're not purposely deciding to kill you.
And that's exactly. Like when they would like put you on the rack and like stretch you to the point where your bones would break and things like that, right? Mm-hmm. Is that second?
Or what would be called maybe a restraint position, like the so-called Palestinian hanging. But these both, while horrific, pale in comparison to the third degree.
Yeah, the third degree is where it really starts to make your skin crawl. This is the kind of torture that was the most insidious and dangerous of all, utterly nightmare fuel. The kind of stuff that you hear in fiction that you would almost question who would come up with this idea. It's all very creative stuff too. So we're talking spikes and blades and boiling oil and fire and things with names that alone will just send shivers up your spine, like the serrated iron tongue shredder.
Not an ironic name.
No,
either.
The hot copper basin for a bassination.
That's the word of the day, destroying someone's eyesight.
That's right. And the stocks that forcibly held the victim's feet over red-hot coals. Until the skin and the foot muscles were burnt black and the bones completely turned to powder.
Wow.
The skin of the feet were also coated in lard beforehand. Which is an extra gruesome detail. And what we just described on that third degree, it's very clear that especially before the advent of modern medicine, someone's chances of surviving any of those was remarkably slim.
Just the infection. Can you imagine?
Infection, the bleeding out from these various wounds.
And it's one of those things too where unless they needed to keep you alive because they really wanted to continue to extract information from you, it's not like they were going to give you any kind of medical attention right away unless it was, you know, worth their while to do so, right?
They might have someone pray for you, but that person might be praying while they're doing that thing to
One like equals one prayer.
And the worst thing is that it's not – for me, the worst thing is that it's not just for interrogation purposes. Sometimes – the whole reason that a human being would have to go through this is so that whatever group is doing the torturing can set an example for what happens if you either defy the group in power or even just some kind of dissenter from the group in power. That bothers me to no end.
The people are starving and there's a widespread theft of grain and someone says, well, we need the bulk of these serfs or peasants or whatever to survive and to farm land. So let's just publicly eviscerate one of them.
Just so they know.
Literally, not just give them a good talking to. Right. Eviscerate their flesh.
Leave the head somewhere visible.
A pike, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can get into arguments about controlling a population through fear or through, you know, the various ways that you can do that from a high level. But, man, it just seems too brutal to make much sense.
And the type of abuse administered here would typically depend on the setting, the transgression, the social status of the victim. So for example, in Europe, Elizabeth Bathory, because of her high station, was not murdered or burned at a stake or impaled. She was walled into a room where she didn't starve to death. She was fed
yeah.
until she died. She was put on, not to be too glib about it, permanent timeout or solitary confinement. And people would argue that that sort of injustice or inequality of consequence occurs today. I think that the four of us would largely agree that mm-hmm. is the case, at least here in the States. And for centuries and centuries, various civilizations across the globe, we all just sort of took it for granted that horrific physical degradations, mutilations, and abuses were par for the course when it came to dissent, a crime, or even rubbing the wrong important person the wrong way. And if we fast forward to the modern day, humanity started to realize this is a problem.
Yeah, where do you think it clicked for humanity, Ben?
In the world wars.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the world wars. That's, I believe, when the public around the world said, what charnel houses, what abattoirs are we building, mm-hmm. you know? And that was a primary impetus for the United Nations to codify protections against torture. And as you had said, Matt, this didn't actually happen or get adopted into law until the 1980s.
Okay, so it took a long time for it to click for humanity.
Right. It took a long time for them to make it official.
Mm-hmm.
There are things before. There are rules of engagement for war, treatment mm-hmm. of POWs. But the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, commonly known as UNCAT or the United Nations Convention Against Torture, wasn't adopted until 1984. It was ratified in 1987. And so they used a definition that's a little bit different from the one we used at the top.
Yeah, this comes from Article 1 of the convention. Quote, for the purpose of this convention, the term torture means any act by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted on a person for such purposes as obtaining from him or a third person information or a confession, punishing him for an act he or a third person has committed or is suspected of having committed, or intimidating or coercing him or a third person, or for any reason based on discrimination of any kind, when such pain or suffering is inflicted by or at the instigation of or with the consent or acquiescence of a public official for other person acting in an official capacity. It does not include pain or suffering arising only from, inherent in, or incidental to lawful sanctions.
Tut, tut. Tut.
Can you unpack that for us, Ben? I read it, but I don't think I took it in.
Well, one of the big things there is that right at the end, putting in lawful sanctions. So if it's part of the law in the country where this is occurring, as this is the type of punishment, it feels like there's a lot of wiggle room there.
Right. We can see the problems with this. So three of the big things that happened, Noel, you made the excellent point about a third person that shows up, because there are people who will gladly die for a cause, but they don't want their children or their spouse to. Mm. And then the second huge point about this is the involvement of a public official or someone acting in an official capacity. So this is banning state-sponsored acts of this sort of violence. This is not banning this is not specifically meant to target, you know, the day Matt snaps and abducts someone. Okay, getting the crazy eyes. Sorry, Matt. Moving on.
What would it take? What would it take for a Matt snap?
A Matt snap?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know. Maybe that's it. You don't know.
Yeah. Someone harming my family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't know that I would abduct anybody.
Thank you, Ben. I feel like you know exactly what the line on Matt Snap is, and God hope we never cross it. We want to be absolutely clear. Of course, Noel, I think you can agree with me here that of the three of us, Matt is probably the nicest, like legitimately, and not prone to abducting people.
Well, of course he's not prone, but when the snap happens, man. Stand back.
I guess you never know when a snap occurs. That's true. The nature of it.
It's very much the nature of it. Mm-hmm. But it could happen to any of us. And we all have our limits. And that's why I think it's interesting you brought up the third party situation, because that is a it's dirty pool, my man, you know, taking someone's loved ones and, you know, using them as a tool to extract information out of someone. That is just like the most horrific thing that you could possibly do, I think, you know?
Or even just like a co-pilot or a partner mm-hmm. or someone who's in the same squad as you or, you know, right. something to that effect.
Because yeah. now you're responsible for the life of another.
Mm-hmm.
So ethically, it puts someone in the position where they have to ask, am I committing murder by inaction? But the third point, so the first point is the thing about a third party. The second point is the state action. And to follow up, the third point here, and one of the most dangerous ones, is the idea of lawful sanctions. What they're saying then is that if there is a sanctioned action, anything from depriving the civilians of a country of food due to an economic sanction or a military incursion that results in the death or mutilation of civilians, that does not count as torture. And this debate continues in the international sphere today. Regrettably, we can probably already get a good spider sense of which countries have what positions. You know?
Well, especially if we go back to the top with that example mm-hmm. of the Navy airman who is, you know, telling people that he's been tortured, and this is part of the Vietnam conflict. And then you imagine historically what we know the U.S. military was doing to civilians in places all over North Vietnam.
Sure.
And, you know, since it's state sanctioned, you know, we're talking about the 60s and 70s then during the Vietnam conflict, but so it's well before a decade before the UN says this is what torture is. But at the same time, both sides are doing one form of torture or another.
That's a great point. And we should also note that in many cases, it's not as if the president or the ruling party or the monarch of a country said, you soldiers go out, torture people. Often this fog of war, mission creep would set in and there would be factions of people or officials acting relatively of their own accord, thinking that the ends justify the means. And so we can already see the problems with this definition, as lengthy as it is and as specific as it attempts to be. But regardless of the imperfections, the concept itself seems noble, right? Stop torturing people, especially when there's not a lot of evidence that it works as intended. So case closed, right?
Not so much. And we'll get into why after a quick sponsor break.
Here's where it gets crazy. The idea that everybody can agree to stop torturing people is the idea that this worked is wrong. Unfortunately, it is so cartoonishly incorrect. According to the scholar Ervand Abramayan, although there were several decades of prohibition against torture generally agreed that spread from Europe to most parts of the world, by the 1980s, that ban was functionally off. The taboo against torture had been broken.
Yes, he argued that torture, quote, returned with a vengeance. And a lot of this had to do with the advent of television or the way television was kind of changing. And it presented an opportunity to break political prisoners and then broadcast the results. The public recantations, kind of like we were mentioning at the top of the show, they wanted that airman to say, I don't believe in the ideologies of the United States government. Mm. They are wrong. That's what they want to be able to broadcast to everyone. And the idea is that if you torture someone enough, you can change, you know, you can make them say what you want mm-hmm. for your ideological means. And just recanting, yeah, political beliefs, using this ideological warfare and political mobilization and the need to win the hearts and minds of people who exist in a country where war is being waged.
It's Orwellian when you think about it, you know. Mm-hmm. And if anything then, according to this expert, in the wake of the world wars, torture as a widespread practice momentarily, maybe, sort of, kind of, a little bit paused for a second. But now, if we fast forward a little closer to the modern age, we find that that is not the case. According to Human Rights Watch, between 2004 and 2005, over 16 countries were documented using torture, state-sponsored torture.
Yeah, and then you go to the war on terror, the global war on terror, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where we know black sites, we've covered this before on an episode, black mm-hmm. sites have been used where torture occurs, and it's not just the United States.
Right. It is not just this is not just an episode picking on the United States, and often these things are occurring through a second or third hand thing. There's mm-hmm. a proxy. So despite being banned, torture continues in countries around the globe, and this ancient practice shows no signs of abating. In fact, our species has effectively leveraged technology to arrive at new forms of physical and psychological abuse. One thing we learned about in the course of our research, which initially didn't sound that bad, was the so-called cold cell treatment. And this is an Uncle Sam original. Prisoners are placed in front of a large air conditioner unit running on full blast. That doesn't sound bad, right, at first?
Probably kind of nice depending on where you are.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for the first day or for maybe even for the first week.
But what about a month?
What about a year?
Ugh.
That is the so-called cold cell treatment. And we should make a point that it's allegedly happened for years.
Mm-hmm.
But we're required technically to say allegedly.
Yeah. I wonder what that does to the human body. And we don't have a lot of information about exactly how cold the air conditioner unit mm-hmm. gets to. But I'm assuming if it's an air conditioner rather than some kind of like a refrigeration device, it's probably in the lower to mid 60s.
Mm-hmm. So it's not fatal. It's probably more psychological.
That's exactly what it is.
So what else have we found? What other technology have we turned to torturous ends?
Electricity. That is one of the major things that's been used in modern times. Everything from cattle prods to stun guns to lasers being used by mostly security forces, like police forces and militaries. Mm. And it's strange to imagine, especially in the United States, the modern stun gun did not originate as a less than lethal weapon for police officers the way we, you know, nowadays see it a lot of the times, a taser, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was a cattle prod, and then it became a way to control prisoners specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of evolved.
Wow. And then also, this would be going to the earlier point you made, Noel, about torture and fiction.
Mm.
This would be where a car battery is hooked up to something and then they shock the person with the car battery.
Which, right? Is a very real thing.
Oh, absolutely.
Here's a weird one.
Mm-hmm.
The so-called white torture.
What is this? I don't know this.
This is psychological, but it sounds very strange. A prisoner is in solitary confinement and everything in their world, everything they encounter, including the food they eat and the plates they eat from, is white, just blank white.
Dude, you know that's in J-Lo's Rider, that like everything in her dressing room has to be white?
Do you think yeah. she originated
Maybe.
This?
They should call it the J-Lo torture.
This is real. That's real. That's a thing? That's not some interior designer being like playful?
No.
I can imagine that being another psychological torture device that just, I don't know, somehow
just
makes –
just wears on you?
Yeah. Especially like, can you imagine combining the cold cell, the white cold cell is what they would call it? Ugh.
With lights on all the time, also no human contact.
Playing the same song over and over.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that might sound like that's a lot for us to put on Jennifer Lopez. But it is in her Rider that everything has to be white.
She has been responsible for some atrocities, though.
That's true.
Have you seen Geely?
I have not.
I haven't either. I heard it was really bad. Atrocity, maybe that's a little overstating the case. So, I did like the cell, though.
I did like the cell as well. I enjoyed it. I felt from the perspective of cinematography, it was just stunning.
The guy that directed that, Tarsem Singh, did those early REM videos, very 90s kind of tableaus with like the rotating the the platform, and he's on with the – anyway, that guy basically invented the look of like the Pearl Jam video from the 90s and those – anyway.
He's got some amazing other movies too.
Well, The Fall. The Fall's a good one.
Oh, and speaking of music, this brings us to another form of technologically advanced torture that longtime listeners are familiar with.
Yeah, it's just music torture, right? Like, and I think a part of it doesn't necessarily have to be incredibly loud, but whenever you see it done and dramatized in film, it's usually some absurd stack of, you know, bass in the trunk kind of car stereo speakers that are just blasting the stuff at really high decibel levels. We're talking about, you know, the idea I think is repetition, right? So it'd be the same song over and over and over and over again, whether it's Metallica or Britney Spears or even a very popular one, Ben, I think you mentioned before on another episode, is the Barney song.
Yep.
Did you know that guy's a tantric sex guru now? The guy that played Barney?
Does he still wear the costume?
No, I think he just...
Oh, I need to get that out of my head already.
He mainly just wears scented oils and lotions.
Oh.
And nothing else.
And a fine musk.
Mm.
The other practice that we found was force feeding, including using some medical advances to feed people rectally, similar to a gross real-life version of that South Park trope.
Yeah. And a lot of this you'll see in the news, and it's not necessarily used as a torture, but as a way to keep people who are prisoners alive if they're having some kind of protest where they're doing self-starvation in protest of their captivity. And so again, it's crazy to think that the method to preserve someone's life can also be used to torture them.
Yes. Yeah. And that goes into an ethical question as well. You know, this is something that we didn't discuss off air, but it just occurred to me now. If somebody wants to die, right, if they want to commit medically assisted suicide of their own accord and they are legally required to stay alive, is that this in a state of pain perhaps from a chronic condition, is that the state aiding in torture? Or is, you know, what's the line there?
That's a tough ethical question. We should...
is there an ethicist in the house? Paul, are you an ethicist? Okay,
Hard no. But, you know, that's something we... I wonder if the UN has pondered that. I haven't seen anything recently, at least.
Well, and let's just... I don't know. I'm going to talk about the elephant in the room, or at least my elephant. You know, the UN kind of gets a lot of flack as being a somewhat toothless organization. Like, you can make these resolutions, but at the end of the day, it's just kind of, you know, words on paper. And there's very little enforcement ability that the UN has. Correct me if I'm wrong.
You are correct. The primary power structure of the United Nations is the UN Security Council, and they can – each member of the UN Security Council can veto an entire concept, so it has to – things have to pass unanimously. So it is very, 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 very difficult. It's not as bad and ineffectual as the predecessor, the League of Nations, but yeah, you're spot on. When do words on paper translate to substantive change?
Yeah, no, that kind of is the question. And that's sort of, you know, when we're talking about the shift of consciousness as a country, when we decide as a people that torture is not okay, but yet if it still is thought by some as being an effective tool, whether or not there are resolutions on the books or not, at the end of the day, if you think it's going to get the job done, you're probably going to figure out a way to get around it and do it, you know, especially when we have things like black sites and, you know, stuff where there's very little oversight and you have heads of these divisions that essentially act as gods of their little fiefdoms, you know. So it's tough. You like, can't, yeah.
Like secret police, for instance, throughout a lot of recent history. And that's the point. That is the stuff they don't want you to know. here in this episode. It's the fact that there are numerous active conspiracies as we speak. We're not talking about 1993. We're not talking about 1974. We're not talking about 2007. We're talking about 2018. As we are recording this, there are numerous active cover-ups and conspiracies allowing various governments around the world, including the United States, but not limited to Uncle Sam, to commit torture, either through proxies or euphemisms like enhanced interrogation or good old-fashioned secret police, as you guys pointed out, black sites, off-the-line item budgets, written out of your history books, and we might never know what happens with it. And this forces us to ask about the future of torture.
And we'll get into that right after a quick word from our sponsor.
So we're back, and Noel, you brought up this excellent point, especially in the case of U.S. intelligence services, military arms. The primary argument for these techniques is that is something along the lines of, well, they might be deplorable, but they do result in valuable, or what they would call actionable, intelligence that can ultimately save lives. And the scenario you'll often hear described by people supporting these programs is the following. It's something called the ticking time bomb scenario.
Yeah, imagine that you're an authority figure, right? Whether this is law enforcement, military, maybe an intelligence officer working for the CIA, whatever it is, you have absolute certainty that there will be some form of attack, a terrorist attack probably, and it's going to happen in the near to immediate future, but you don't know exactly where, you don't know exactly when. How do you find out? This is the big quandary. How do you gain that information without, you know, stumbling upon a piece of paper that has it written out?
So let's take it a step further and say that maybe we are those investigators and we have one or more suspects in custody, and with the same amount of certitude, we know that they know where the attack will be. Maybe we have it narrowed down to three cities, but they know which city and which day.
And we know that, you know, torture is banned. It may still be one of the only ways to extract information, this kind of information, before hundreds of thousands of innocent people die, or at least that's the justification, right?
Yeah, and this is often depicted as the ultimate dilemma, at least for modern times, regarding torture. And experts continue to debate it today, whether or not it's a good idea to save all of these lives by torturing this person. Can you even get information that would be reliable enough to save people if you did indeed torture one of these suspects? There's a lot to unpack there.
Right. Like, do you or do we in this scenario want to be responsible for thousands of innocent people dying because we refuse to bend or break the law?
Yeah, and international law that's set forth by, you know, the United Nations, and look, it's just one of those things. Like, it's a big moral quandary that seems to have probably the most weight behind it in our modern times.
So now our question becomes, if we want to be Machiavellian, if we want to cast morals aside, now our question shifts a little, and it's the ultimate question here. Does it work? As we alluded to earlier in the show, does physically or psychologically torturing someone compel them to provide truthful, useful information? The answer is no. Torture does not work, at least in the way that the tormentors might publicly intend. Again, that's publicly. So there's an article from Scientific American by a guy named Michael Shermer, and it's called "We've Known for 400 Years That Torture Doesn't Work." In this article, there is a fascinating anecdote about the Duke of Brunswick in Germany during the time of the Inquisition. He goes to visit the inquisitors, and he wants to oversee their use of torture to extract information from people accused of witchcraft, right? The majority of whom were women. So the Jesuits told the Duke that the inquisitors are doing their duty. They're only arresting people who have been implicated in the confessions of other witches when they were put to the question, which was the term for torture. And so the Duke's a little bit skeptical, And he thinks, well, maybe people just say anything to get this to stop. So he invited the Jesuits to come visit him and go with him to a dungeon to witness a woman being stretched on the rack, second degree of torture, like we had mentioned earlier. And the Duke said to this lady, while she's mid-torture, by the way, he says, "Now, woman, you are a confessed witch. I suspect these two men of being warlocks. What do you say?" And he looks at the executioners and he says, "Another turn of the rack, executioners." And the woman immediately said, "No, no, no, you are quite right. I have often seen them at the Sabbat. They can turn themselves into goats, wolves, and other animals. Several witches have had children by them. One woman even had 8 children whom these men fathered. The children had heads like toads and legs like spiders." And the Duke turned to the Jesuits and said, "Should I torture you until you confess?"
Jeez.
You get real creative when you're put to the question.
Mm-hmm. And that's how we know, like, the problem with torture is if the primary goal is to receive truthful information, again, morals aside, then we have to think of the primary goal of the victim, which is just to stop this immense, unending pain.
Well, and also mentioned in that article is something that has really shaped the way I've viewed torture over the years. Christopher Hitchens, a writer that I very much admired to a certain extent. Several years ago, while he was still living, he was writing for Vanity Fair still, and he went and he was himself waterboarded. And, you know, he was famously hawkish about war, believing that there were good reasons to go to war and to eliminate terrorism, and you know, you can look at his views. But he didn't believe that waterboarding was that big of a deal. But he went, it occurred to him, and his quote from the article was, "If waterboarding does not constitute torture, then there is no such thing as torture." Because he had a terrible experience. He almost immediately after being subjected to the water pouring on his head, he said, "No, that felt like I was drowning. That is the worst thing that's ever happened to me."
And I'm sure most listeners know what waterboarding is, but I mean, just to set the scene, it's like you've got a rag over your face. There is a torrent of water being poured over your mouth and nose to the point where it's constant enough that you just can't catch your breath. And I'm imagining that the rag is creating almost a suction against your face where you just like are totally incapable of drawing breath. And so I would argue that this is not only a physical torture because we know it's very unpleasant physically when you can't breathe. It's also a psychological torture because it's this sensation that it's creating of not being able to catch your breath and of dying, of drowning, which sounds terrifying.
Well, yeah. And the whole point of this whole thing, though, is that Christopher Hitchens was alluding to the fact that he would have said anything to make that stop. And he couldn't imagine experiencing that as someone like being told, "You know where X is. You know what time it's going to happen. Tell me where it is," and then proceed with the torture over and over and over.
It just seems so counterintuitive to me that people would think that this is a smart way to get people to tell them the truth. Mm-hmm. It just seems to me that it's obvious that it would be the opposite.
Yeah, it's a smart way to get people to tell you whatever you want them to say.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But whether or not it's true is very, very different. And this ticking time bomb thought experiment, let's be honest, it's way too cut and dry. In reality, if there's someone in captivity, they may or may not be responsible for this thing, right? They may or may not have accurate information, even if they are responsible. Maybe they're not on the inner circle for some specific operation. Then they might not know anything useful. They might just make stuff up out of whole cloth.
Like the toad heads. That's what I'm saying. That's like creative writing type stuff. Yeah. Like, you know, you are going to dig deep into your imagination for, you know, to make that rack tightening cease.
Absolutely. And despite the continued practices of what we could call gray area interrogation and or torture, the U.S. government itself publicly agrees that torture is not really effective. There was a 2014 report by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. They analyzed millions of internal CIA documents related to the torture of people suspected of terrorism. And the Senate concluded the CIA's use of its enhanced interrogation techniques was not an effective means of acquiring intelligence or gaining cooperation from detainees. It also adds that multiple CIA detainees fabricated information resulting in faulty intelligence. And that leads us to ask, if torture doesn't work, what does? Is there something better than torture?
Well, yeah, pretty much the opposite of torture. There are multiple studies that show that this might be the thing, the way to get information from people, building rapport. It works wonders and it has a significantly higher chance of creating a successful relationship between interrogator and interrogatee by actually being like showing empathy and I understand your situation. I mean, there's a whole host of lines you can go down.
For sure. I guess the problem there is, though, if you have people that are trained, they are hardened to the point where they're not going to play nice with you at all, you know? I mean, it's one thing if you're like a scared kid or like someone who's been accused of a crime and you're just all, you know, you don't know which way is up. You could probably coerce someone into telling you some stuff and getting them to cry and talk about their mommy or something. Like, I'm being a jerk, but you know what I'm saying? Like, but if someone is like a terrorist or an operative of some kind, I don't think that's going to work.
I don't know. You might find that there's –
really? I should just be nicer?
I'm just saying there. You might find that there is a vulnerable human inside each and every one of us.
It also depends on the x-axis of time.
That's fair.
So if someone is detained for life with no human contact
– isn't that torture in and of itself?
Except for you,
then?
It is. It is. But it's a chess level torture.
Yeah.
And the thing is that it appears to – it appears to work. There are different studies that confirm. There's one called the Who, What, and Why of Human Intelligence Gathering from this journal, Applied Cognitive Psychology. They surveyed 152 interrogators and they found that rapport and relationship building techniques were employed most often and perceived to be the most effective regardless of context and intended outcome, particularly they found in comparison to confrontational techniques. And that's from the interrogators themselves.
Wow. Yeah, there's another study called Interviewing High-Value Detainees. It sampled 64 practitioners and detainees, and it found that, quote, detainees were more likely to disclose meaningful information and earlier in the interview when rapport-building techniques were used.
So those are two examples of studies that find this approach superior to confrontational or abusive behavior, although I do appreciate the point of rapport building and solitary confinement being just another form of torture, arguably. With these stories we hear from various global conflicts in the study of torture, they indicate the same conclusions, not just from academics and historians, but from the firsthand accounts of other interrogators. And so we have to ask ourselves, if torture does not work, at least in terms of providing truthful information or eliciting it, if it only blinds someone to the point that they will say something, anything to prevent further abuse, then why do we as a species persist? There are several reasons, and absolutely none of them are appealing. First, in some belief systems, certain methods of punishment may be prescribed for certain types of transgressions. This is where you hear about traditional methods of punishment, right? Or execution for the violation of socio-spiritual mores. That's a word I made up. But I'm going to stick with it.
What, mores?
Intense word.
Socio-spiritual.
I'm joking.
And then there's the other one. Second, torture is also used successfully to some degree to send a message, and this goes to an anecdote. Now, I know there's a touchy geopolitical situation with Russia right now, but there's a short story or an account of what happened when the Soviet Union at the time had four Soviet diplomats kidnapped in 1985. Did you all hear about this?
I have no recollection of this.
So in 1985, these four Soviet diplomats were kidnapped by a fundamentalist group called the Islamic Liberation Organization. Russia dispatched something called its Alpha Group. They were tasked with counterterrorism hostage rescue situations. They learned that one of the hostages had been killed, a guy named Arkady Katkov. And so what they did is they tracked down and located one of the leaders of the kidnappers, or possibly a relative, and they wanted to send a message to the terrorist. They tortured this person that they captured with absolutely no intention of gaining information, absolutely no intention of letting them survive. Alpha Group castrated the hostage, cut him into pieces, and sent pieces of him to the hostage takers. And they also said, we know who your other relatives are, and we know where they live, and we know their routines. The three hostages were released and dropped off near the Soviet embassy, and there were there haven't been Russian officials taken captive since then. And then people argue back and forth this scary story, but what it shows is that their goal in torture then was not to learn anything new. Their goal was to send a signal, just like in the early days of civilization where someone said, let us make an example, a disgusting, repugnant example.
Yeah, rather than flaying some prisoners and putting them on spikes throughout your whole kingdom, you just cut one person up to take this one group out.
And you could argue, again, morals aside, that that was a short-term solution, that the signaling did result in the release of those other hostages. But over the long term, is that a solution?
I don't know.
But for now, the practice of torture continues. We had talked before about several – like we've mentioned several forms of torture that seem arcane but are still around, right? Like Noel, you mentioned when we were talking about foot whipping, you had told me before that that's not an ancient practice, right?
Right. Well, I mean, maybe the origins of it are, but I know there was an incident with I believe it was Qusay Hussein who participated in whipping the feet of I believe it was an Iraqi soccer team. You know about this?
The whole team?
I think so. Yeah, apparently Uday Hussein was a pretty sore loser when the a group of Iraqi soccer stars did not win the Asian Cup, and he had them tortured by having the soles of their feet whipped after losing the World Cup qualifying match. So, yeah, it's definitely something that's still around.
And that's technically – that's going to be state-sponsored then because he was a Hussein.
Yeah.
Wow. So well, boys, I feel awful.
Well, there's a silver lining, right?
What?
I don't know. We were just talking off air about, you know, the future of torture. Maybe there's a kind of torture that doesn't really hurt you physically.
Oh, okay.
Some sort of virtual torture?
Yeah. Yeah. Have you guys seen Altered Carbon, the Netflix show?
Mm-hmm. I have. Yeah.
I think it's a lot of fun. It's got problems, but there's a particular scenario where there's this like shop or looks like a medical facility where somebody who wants to extract information can pay these techs to put somebody under. You kind of have to abduct them first. So there's that. Shoot them up in the neck with some kind of, you know, sleepy meds. And then you put them on this table and put all these electrodes attached to their brain. And they end up in a virtual room where somebody can go in there and wreak all kinds of virtual havoc on them. And apparently, you know, there's like a readout of the way their body's reacting. And while it's all psychological, they apparently feel it in the virtual world, right?
Mm. Yeah. It's a terrifying extrapolation of both virtual reality and torture, certainly. And I can imagine a world, this world, where there is some type of interface that makes it blurs the line between real and virtual, like the AR stuff that we are seeing right now, augmented reality and virtual reality. I can totally imagine that occurring. I wonder how effective it would be, or if it would be the same thing.
Ben, do you not still think the ethical quandaries still apply, and also the efficacy?
Yeah, absolutely. They would still apply, at least in the psychological sense, because unless the person's mind was also erased, their experience was also erased, they would still remember this and bear the psychological burden of what occurred. Sort of like you can wake up from a nightmare, but you still remember it. and it's still going to affect your behavior.
Sure.
So perhaps it's still better than the alternative of shredding people's tongues or flaying them, but it's a difference of degree, one might say.
Yeah. Man, I watched a video on the Brazen Bull to get ready for this, and I almost didn't even want to bring it up, but
is that the thing where they put him inside of a thing?
It's a statue made out of bronze, or at least theoretically there has not been found. Like, they've never actually seen a full Brazen Bull.
I just read accounts of it.
Yeah, but it was a statue of a bull that was large enough for a human to fit inside, and they would put a fire on the bottom of it, and the entire thing would heat up because of the substance it's made of. All of the metal, it quickly heats up to the same temperature. The person inside is pretty much cooked. And it was – oh, there was also this whole thing where there's stories, or at least accounts, of the bull makes an actual bull sound when the person is being cooked. And it's based on the idea of the single air hole that goes into the bull is actually from the mouth of this Brazen Bull statue. And the only way to get oxygen as smoke is filling up the bull and you're in there being cooked and dying is to breathe through that hole, and it makes like a cow sound when you're breathing through it. Mm. It was the most horrifying thing. I mean, there are gross, terrible things of cutting up and all this, but the concept of being locked into an oven in that way while you can hear whoever is in charge – like laughing, because it was supposedly done as like a form of entertainment. Not only punishment, but entertainment.
Well, that goes in too, when we're talking about some of these older civilizations where the torture was kind of entertainment. Like even, you know, being a gladiator, for example, that was a punishment. That was a form of torture. I mean, you had a fighting chance, I guess, but it was also done for, you know, the amusement of the government and then to keep the people happy with the bread and circuses and all that stuff.
And religion was also functioning as government too for much of the time. So if it was a religious practice, if we must, you know, rip the hearts out of the living so that the sun continues to rise or that the eclipse ends, then it's still a state-sponsored action.
Mm-hmm.
And this brings us to questions for you folks. Do you believe that torture does produce results? Do you believe that the ends justify the macabre means? And if so or if not, why? We would like to hear from you. This is the part of the show where Matt, Noel, and I let you know that we are on the internet. That's all true. We are on Instagram. We're on Facebook. Join our discussion page. Here's where it gets crazy, where you can find us interacting from time to time. You can also find us on Twitter, but we're not just on the internet anymore, folks. The rumors are true. We've branched out to another platform, the good old telephone.
Yes. We now have a toll-free number that you can call and leave us a voice message. And spoiler alert, we might make a couple episodes where we feature you on the show. Okay, it's going to happen. But we just need you to leave the messages. So here it is. Write this down. Put it in your phone. Do what you got to do. 833-STDWYTK. Let's do that again with numbers. 833-783-9985. If you call that number right now, you will hear Ben's voice and then leave a message. That's all. It's super simple.
Hey, and if you have some sort of phone aversion, you don't like touching plastic buttons. I guess that could apply to a keyboard too. Doesn't matter if it's a specific phone aversion. You can reach us on the internet. Like Ben said, we are there at Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram, and just Conspiracy Stuff on Twitter and Facebook. And if you don't want to do any of that stuff, phone, internet, fax.
Yeah.
We don't have a fax, but we should. That should be our next antiquated communication means that we come up with.
That would actually be amazing if we had a fax machine that just sat next to it. Oh, my gosh.
It makes a cool sound, that's for sure.
All right, that's next.
Yeah, that's next. So, before, in the meantime, you could send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.